For the south and east of Northern Ireland and the eastern side of Scotland, you're in with a better chance of seeing some sunshine and a high of 7. Good night.
Thanks, Philip. This is BBC Radio 4. Now, Dickens books on the BBC. Penelope Wilton reads the final instalment from Claire Tomalin's acclaimed new biography, Charles Dickens, A Life. In tonight's extract, the 52-year-old Dickens has put the bitter breakup of his marriage behind him. He continues to adore Nellie Ternan, with whom Claire Tomalin surmises he had a child who died in infancy. Meanwhile, the extraordinary pace at which he's lived and worked begins to catch up with him.
With the publication of Our Mutual Friend in November 1865, his best work was almost done. 1865 was also the year in which the trouble with his foot began to make things difficult for him. It seems clear to modern medical opinion that it was gout. From now on, he appears as a man assailed, not merely keeping going by strength of will, but forcing the pace, at the cost of increasingly distressing symptoms. Nellie Ternan remained his darling, but she was not always easy, and he was not always well. His son Henry remembered his heavy moods of deep depression, yet he never allowed himself to sink into permanent gloom, and even now there were many more accounts of his charm and conviviality than of his low moments. He was the inimitable still, and would be to the end, with his own trick of putting aside agony and exhaustion and reappearing suddenly like a clown from behind the curtain, full of energy, amazing everyone with his good humour and laughter and his determination to get on with the chief work of his life. In 1866, a new figure appeared in Dickens's life who did a good deal to cheer him. This was George Dalby. He was 35, just married, a theatre manager out of work, and keen to take on the running of Dickens's next reading tour. Dalby's Dickens is the boy's Dickens, the Pickwickian Dickens, at ease with his male companions and masculine pleasures. They laughed and joked together like boys, and enjoyed the small rituals of travel. The artful sandwich favoured by Dickens, French roll, butter, parsley, hard-boiled egg and anchovy, the mixing of the gin punch, the game of cribbage. Dickens said Dalby was as tender as a woman and as watchful as a doctor. Dalby, that Dickens had given him, the brightest chapter of my life. Dalby needed to be resilient, because over the next 4 years he was with Dickens for many months of continuous travel. Readings brought in much better money than book sales, and Dickens was desperate to earn, feeling he was in a trap surrounded by dependents. He had my wife's income to pay, and my boys with a curse of limpness on them. There were needy sisters-in-law and orphaned nephews and nieces. There was his wife's sister, Georgina, she was still running his house, and his daughters. There was Nellie, who had given up her life to him. If money was the basic reason for the reading tours, something else kept him always eager to continue with them. Whatever the physical and emotional strain, his audiences nourished his spirit. They laughed when he wanted them to laugh, trembled and shed tears when he meant them to tremble or shed tears. The triumph was paid for with pains in foot, hand, heart, and left eye, nervous seizures, sleeplessness, and, as he told John Forster, depression at the end of each tour. In June 1867, his diary shows him looking at houses with Nellie in the suburb of Peckham. The house they settled on was already named Windsor Lodge. What could be more respectable? They must have laughed together about their invented identities, as the rates on Windsor Lodge were paid at first under the name Francis Turnham and then Charles Tringham. They needed to agree on what the two servants would call them and on how letters were to be addressed to Nellie, and to discourage friendly and curious neighbours who might notice the comings and goings of Mr. Turnham or was it Tringham? And remark on his resemblance to the writer Charles Dickens. The writing he did that summer was sad stuff. George Silverman's Explanation and Holiday Romance. These works show diminished power and poor judgment and are read today only because they are by Dickens. But they brought in money, and he kept going. After his 1868 tour of America, he returned to Gad's Hill. Things in general looked like work again, he wrote to Dalby. He wanted to look forward to be making plans and to talk about the new reading he had prepared, taken from Oliver Twist, Sykes and Nancy, giving the murder of Nancy by Bill Sykes. Very horrible, but very dramatic. It was meant to be sensational, and he was pleased to have made something so powerful. One critic said he had felt an irresistible desire to scream, and a physician warned of the danger of contagious hysteria in the audience. But an actress encouraged Dickens by telling him the public had been looking out for a sensation these last 50 years, and now they have got it. In Chester, on the 18th of April, 1869, Dickens had a stroke. He did not describe it as such, but to Georgina he wrote, "My weakness and deadness are on my left side, and if I don't look at anything I try to touch with my left hand, I don't know where it is." The following day he began to feel more like himself, read A Christmas Carol, and travelled on to Bolton for the next reading. No one can imagine their own death, even when they know it is approaching. Dickens rejected and defied his illness with a spirit that would not flinch or budge. At the same time, he sensed danger and set about putting order into his affairs. His days were now packed with business meetings, readings, discussions with illustrators, plans for more improvements at Gad's, changes to the garden and the new conservatory. Then there were speeches to deliver, dinners and receptions, social obligations to insistent friends, to politicians and even to royalty. And woven through all this, the writing of his new novel, The Mystery of Edwin Drood, a murder mystery and a love story. On the 15th of March, 1870, he gave his final reading at St. James's Hall. It was an occasion of high emotion for reader and public. Crowds were turned away as an audience of 2,000 gathered inside, many paying only a shilling for a seat. And when he came onto the platform, they rose to their feet to cheer him. He gave them A Christmas Carol and The Trial of Pickwick. Forster was in the audience and thought he had never read so well, with delicacy and the quiet sadness of farewell. Dalby was backstage, ready to support him as necessary. He did not falter, although he could not say Pickwick, making it Pickswick, Picnics, or Pickwicks. At the end, the audience called him back several times until he spoke some farewell words, telling them to expect his new novel's first instalment in 2 weeks. And then, "From these garish lights I vanish now for evermore, with a heartfelt, grateful, respectful, affectionate farewell." The Mystery of Edwin Drood sold well from the start, outstripping Our Mutual Friend by 10,000 and reaching 50,000 a number. Drood is an unfinished mystery, which has divided opinion sharply even among Dickens's warmest admirers. It is the achievement of a man who is dying and refusing to die, who would not allow his illness and failing powers to keep him from exerting his imagination or to prevent him from writing. And as such, it is an astonishing and heroic enterprise. Through May and June, he continued working on Drood. One night at Gad's Hill, he sat up talking with his daughter Katie. He said he had wished he'd been a better father, a better man, and told her things he had never discussed with her before. no doubt concerning the separation from her mother and his relations with Nellie. During the morning of Wednesday, the 8th of June, he looked in at the Falstaff Inn to cash a cheque. After this, Georgina was the only person known to have seen him until after 6 in the evening. She said that Dickens came to the house in the late afternoon to write letters and entered the dining room at 6, looking unwell. He sat down and she asked him if he felt ill, and he replied, "Yes, very ill. I've been very ill for the last hour." He made an effort to struggle against the fit that was coming on him, and talked incoherently and soon very indistinctly. Georgina remembered their final exchange. Her, "Come and lie down," and his reply, "Yes, on the ground," as he collapsed on the floor and lost consciousness. Haunting last words. Now at last, the core of his being, the creative machine that had persisted in throwing up ideas, visions, and characters for 36 years, was stilled. Katie and her sister Mamie, summoned by telegram, arrived about midnight. In the morning, his son Charlie arrived. The London specialist they had sent for came and said there had been a brain hemorrhage, and everyone understood there could be no good outcome. Nellie arrived in the afternoon. A long day went by. Soon after 6 in the evening, Dickens gave a sigh. A tear appeared in his right eye and ran down his cheek. And he stopped breathing. The funeral arrangements were troublesome. Charlie, knowing that his father had expressed a wish to be buried in the part of Kent he loved so well, began by approaching the vicar of the nearby church. Then a pressing request was brought from Rochester Cathedral that Dickens should be buried there, not outside as he had wanted. On Monday, the Times ran an editorial calling for Dickens to be buried in Westminster Abbey. This galvanised Forster and Charlie, and at 11 o'clock they were in London to see Dean Stanley. Forster explained the conditions insisted on by Dickens in his will, that there should be 3 plain mourning coaches only, no funeral pomp of any kind, and no public announcement of the time or place of his burial. The Dean agreed, and on the 14th of June, the great bell was tolled, and the coffin was carried through the cloisters into the nave. The doors were closed. There was no singing and no eulogy, just quiet organ music as a background to the reading of the burial service. The grave was left open for 2 days for the public to see the coffin lying 5 feet below the stone floor of Poet's Corner. Thousands filed past, bringing the heartfelt, useless notes they had written for him, and offerings of flowers that filled up and overflowed the grave. In his will, he had expressed his wish to have no memorial. Instead, he said, "I rest my claims to the remembrance of my country upon my published works, and to the remembrance of my friends upon their experience of me." Nothing could have been better. He was, and he continued to be, a national treasure, an institution, a part of what makes England, England. And he continues to be read all over the world.
Penelope Wilton concluded our series of extracts from Claire Tomalin's Charles Dickens: A Life. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer Elizabeth Allard. Over the coming weeks, the major season Dickens on the BBC looks forward to the 200th birthday of the writer in 2012, with an exciting mix of programming from drama to documentary and discussion programmes across radio and television. Thank you. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to 1. Now, here's the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency. A 0015 today, Saturday the 3rd of December. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Biscay, Trafalgar, Fitzroy and Seoul. The general synopsis at 1800. Low southeast Iceland 962 moving rapidly east, expected 270 miles north of Viking 954 by 1800 Saturday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Cromarty, Forth. South or southwest, veering west 6 to gale 8. Increasing severe gale 9 at times. Rain or squally wintry showers, good, occasionally poor. Tyne, Dogger. Southwest, veering west 6 to gale 8. Showers, moderate or good.